I'm very excited about the next session, and I know a lot of people have been asking me when the grumpy strategists were going to be appearing. I feel like you're like a little star pair now. So we've already heard earlier from Dr. Marcus Hellyer, the head of research at Strategic Analysis Australia, but he's now going to be joined by his colleague, Mr. Michael Shoebridge, a director at Strategic Analysis Australia. I'd love to invite you both up to the stage. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for the chance to have this chat with you. We're going to talk between ourselves for about 20 minutes and then have about 10 minutes of questions.
So I have the app. Michael can't steer the app. I can, so send the questions in.
And we're going to cover four broad topics. So we're going to talk about what does the world we're in look like? What's the so what for Australia, Australian policy? And then what can we do about that? And then finish with a bit about, so if any of the things that we need to do are actually essential, then what kind of defence organisation should we have? What are the big issues? And I suppose the theme of today is we're actually in a crisis, both in our strategic situation and in our defence institution. And those twin crises shouldn't mean everybody's happy and we have policy continuity. So let me start. Marcus, head of research at Strategic Analysis Australia, you've been doing deep research about the dangerous world that we're in.
We are in a dangerous world. I'll just start off by saying, when I sort of leave the bunker up in the Brindabellas and come out into the real world, a lot of people think we're the same person. So we've set that to rest. We are actually different people, okay? So that's on the record. So look, just sitting here today, I've been struck by something that has, in the last month or so, has been a constant reoccurring kind of impression, and that is that sense of crisis. No one's in Australia is really stating that. So I think Mr. Hastings came the closest to saying that today, that our long-term ally is something different to what we have relied on for a long time. And yet, again and again, we have these presentations of essentially saying we need to deepen our relationship with the US, we need to intertwine our industrial bases. And yet, when I look out at the world and I see what the US is doing, I don't need to go through all of the things that we've been sort of looking at breathlessly for the last month. But just as one example, today, President Trump told Ukraine, you shouldn't have started this war. So everything that was black is white, night is day, everything has been turned upside down. I don't think we can just sit here and assume that things will keep going the way they are. And we were chatting offline before, and I'm almost thinking, are we on the right team? And you said, well, look, maybe not. That's not the right question. It's like the team we want to be on doesn't want any other players.
Well, is there a team, was my comment. So when I think about the dangerous world, everything that's been in all these white papers since 2009 is still true. Geopolitical competition, military aggression, massive growth in militaries, particularly of China's, increasing nuclear weapon building and different regimes pursuing nuclear weapons, a war in the Middle East, a war in Ukraine, but now layered over the top, we have an America that was already changing in adverse ways before Mr. Trump got his second term. Hmm. And so now we have an extra layer of danger, and we need to at least acknowledge it and not pretend everything is fine. You know, I was struck when the UK High Commissioner, very eloquent, I thought, when you said, are the fundamentals of AUKUS still secure? She said, well, we've had meetings with Marco Rubio and Pete Hegseth, and they've both assured us AUKUS is supported, so we can park that as a non-issue. That's not the point. It's not, do we have some supportive words at this moment from two Trump administration officials? It's AUKUS is about maintaining a rules-based global order with a focus on an increasingly dangerous Indo-Pacific, and doing that in a very long-term, stable way with two key partners, the UK and US. Well, the US doesn't look like it's upholding rules. He's breaking rules domestically and internationally. So the point of your question, I thought, she entirely worked around, which is, what's the actual founding idea that means we want to do AUKUS?
Yeah, so I note that the Deputy Prime Minister / Defence Minister, Richard Miles, has a number of times has continued to use this language of rules-based global order and said that the US, we can rely on the US to uphold the rules-based global order. I don't see it that way at all. I mean, President Trump doesn't believe in rules other than the ones he sets. He doesn't believe in order. He's a disruptor. And he certainly doesn't believe in global constructs. I mean, he's withdrawing the US from international organisations. So this RGBO, I think, is dead in the water at this point
in time. It is not just resting, is it? I think another interesting thought is a lot of people say, well, look, it's really just lasting out this next 4 years, and after that, things will be back to normal. No, we're watching a changed America in a changed world. So it isn't a matter of holding our breath. Now, the last Grumpy Strategist episode, we talked about the way the government appears to be dealing with Trump is like a small animal, a squirrel or a mouse, that's faced with an aggressive predator. And what science tells you is the mouse or the squirrel freezes and keeps very still, because predators are very attuned to movement, but their eyesight's not so good if you keep still. Or you can't freeze for 4 years.
So to go back to my question to the High Commissioner, when I sort of think about the underpinnings, the original underpinnings of AUKUS, strategically, yes, that was about presenting a strategic counterweight to the growth of CCP, Chinese power in the Indo-Pacific, and it was presented as increasing our common ability to deter Chinese aggression. When you sort of look at the way the US thought about it, when they articulated it, it was articulated in terms of deterring Chinese or responding to Chinese operations off Taiwan or in the South China Sea. Again, when I look at President Trump, I see absolutely no inclination to fight China about Taiwan. At the moment, Trump's beefs with China are purely economic. They are not issues that are amenable to being solved through military power. So I'm struggling at the moment to see what is the fundamental underpinning of AUKUS Pillar 1.
Well, one way I look at what we're seeing out of America in both Ukraine and Gaza is America is sending a signal that they're about American business and they're not about providing security. They're not a security provider. Look at what President Trump and his administration are saying about Gaza. So someone else needs to either remove the Gazans or secure the Gazans. Other people's money need to fund reconstruction, but America will own it and do the reconstruction. So there's no American security involvement. In fact, they're stepping out. And then Ukraine, it's the same. So the idea of a deal with Mr. Putin that accepts the boundaries that he's managed to seize, gives up on any NATO security guarantee to Ukraine, and cuts his European allies out of the discussions until they're ended, and puts European actors in the frame for providing any security, explicitly saying America won't. And the business aspect is, the good news is the US and Russia will get back to business with Mr. Putin offering a return to American oil and gas industry.
So, yes.
America as a global security provider, no. America as a global business actor, yes.
Yes, we've seen Afghanistan hung out to dry, so President Biden copped a lot of criticism, I think rightly, for botching the actual withdrawal, but the decision came from President Trump. We're seeing Europe essentially being told it's all your problem, and we're seeing Ukraine hung out to dry. What makes us think we're special?
Well, I think we're special because we're small and far away and keeping very, very still.
So a couple of things. There's a few things we like to think make us special. One is the ANZUS Treaty. Here's the ANZUS Treaty. It's essentially a couple of paragraphs on a couple of pieces of paper, and most of us are familiar with it, but it basically says if one of us is attacked, we agree to consult. As Peter Layton, a very astute commentator, said recently, that agree to consult was the language that was in the accord under which Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. So the guarantors of Ukraine's security, which included Russia and the US, Great Britain, agreed to consult. So I don't think President Trump will see that as any kind of ironclad guarantee he has to do something to help us. The other thing that tends to make us feel special is we had a very nice presentation yesterday at the welcome drinks from the director of the Australian War Memorial, who gave us the standard inspiring and quite moving speech on 100 years of shared bloodshed, shared mateship with the US. President Trump does not care.
No.
He does not care. So again, what makes us think we're any different from Afghanistan, Greenland, Ukraine, NATO?
Well, you know, amongst all the heat, light and noise of Mr. Trump, he's consistent about two things. Tariffs. Tariffs are a tool of American prosperity. And I think we'll see far fewer exceptions in Trump term two than in Trump term one. And the other one is that allies are free riders who weaken America and always want things from America. And so he seems seems happier working with known adversaries like Mr. Putin. And let's think about Mr. Trump meeting with Xi Jinping, like he started dealing with Putin, where instead of the European allies finding out about what's happening as he concludes deals, it's us US allies in the Indo-Pacific. Because Xi Jinping offered Obama exactly that kind of arrangement back in 2012. He said China and America should have a new kind of great power relationship where they both meet, they solve theirs and the world's problems, and tell everybody else what the outcomes were. Well, I think that is a prospect that's entirely credible in our part of the world with Mr. Trump and Xi Jinping. So I'm not at all certain about the secure foundations of a strategic policy that banks on a reliable America. And let's talk now about what does an unreliable America look like? And I'd make an argument we're starting to see some risks in America under Joe Biden with things like America's ability to supply the military equipment that we order.
So I think we have both been very strong advocates for Australian SMEs. That doesn't mean we say the primes who do fantastic work here should leave or that we shouldn't be buying equipment from them. But like many of the speakers we've heard from today, we do believe there needs to be much greater investment in Australian SMEs and building Australian capability. And the evidence for that, as we've pointed out a number of times, is that US industry cannot meet the US military's own demands. No. And then beyond that, the US will determine which of its friends or partners or simply customers have first call on what's left. Mm-hmm. And so what we've seen is that some of the programs that have been government priorities since the 2020 DSU, so long-range guided missiles like LRASM, for example,
JASM,
we still don't have. And that is not for lack of money.
Well, I've got the numbers here. You're normally the guy with the numbers, Marcus, so just to confuse the audience, I have the numbers here. So budget estimates, 23-24, which last published annual report, LRASM, the budget provision at the start of the financial year was $330 million. The end result, the actual expenditure, $101 million. So $222 million shortfall from the plan. JASM, budget estimates at the start of the financial year, $180 million. Actual expenditure, $28 million. AIM-9X and AIM-120, $387 million budgeted. Actual, $57 million. Now, what that tells me is...
These are all programs that governments of both stripes have said they're accelerating.
Yes.
And we're going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, well, acceleration can be positive and negative.
Yes, it is a vector quantity.
But it's interesting, isn't it? So there's a will to buy these weapons, and there's a will to order them from the American companies. But the money's there, the production isn't. Now, the reasons you've said are right. So there are production constraints. Look at most American military programs. There are delays through supply chain problems, COVID recovery, and larger than expected orders. So delays across the board in the companies themselves. And then there's the other problem that America is its own priority first, and everybody else is racked further down the priority list. And so far, Ukraine and Israel and Europe have outranked Australia as priority customers. So relying on America increasingly for the things our military needs, already in peacetime is a busted flush. We need to do something else as well.
What's my least favourite defence platitude or phrase? There's many, but probably my least favourite one is the one that the GWEO program seemed to celebrate as a sign of moderation and deliberation. It is crawl, walk, run. We are going to develop our GWEO enterprise through this process of crawl, walk, run. Well, guess what? The world is running. The Houthis, the Ukrainians, everybody in the world, else in the world, is developing an indigenous guided missile capability at the pace of running, and yet we keep patting ourselves on the back for crawling towards a future that's running away from us. So, look, I don't have a problem with building missile factories here that will build US or Norwegian missiles, fine. But we need to be backing Australian companies that already have the capability to build guided weapons, that have the ability to build drones, that have this amazing capability already here. And to me, that is, Andrew, if you get elected, you know, that is the one thing that I tell you now. We have to back Australian companies that have the ability to do this now. If you unleash them, they will run. If you unleash them, they will run.
And Sovereign is not an Australian business number. Huawei and Hikvision have Australian business. business numbers. Sovereign is Australian-owned, so that we are the ultimate priority.
Sorry, I just got to check with my bookie here.
But the primes have a really valuable essential role, but they're not sovereign if they're a foreign prime. It's very simple. So self-reliance and hedging, I think, is our answer. And if you see, most other sane American allies have been doing that already, and they'll do even more of it even faster under this current US administration. So South Korea and Japan building their own capabilities and seeking out new partnerships. You heard about the UK with Italy and Japan on a future aircraft. They're all looking for partners in addition to their American partner. And that is probably the most palatable thing to say that we're doing when you turn up in Washington as well, rather than looking like a mendicant who wants to hand over suitcases full of cash with no strings attached. So hedging and self-reliance go hand in hand. And the next government, whoever's in government, will have a big opportunity with the choice of the general purpose frigate partner. Because as Mr. Hastie said, when you're dealing with a defense company, their government is normally standing behind supporting them. And certainly in the case of Japan, Germany, I think that's true, but Japan wants a strategic industrial partnership with Australia. And that frigate decision is a chance to have that happen.
Yeah, look, I don't think we're very good at hedging. So if you took any company who's had two core strands of business and it was embarking on one path that was high risk, it would hedge by embarking on a lower risk path on the other line of business. But when I look at the Royal Australian Navy, it's two core lines of business, our surface combat and subsurface combat. We picked a risky path with the attack class submarine, and then rather than taking a safe path with the surface combat replacement, we've adopted an extremely risky path with the Hunter class frigate. And then we decided, well, the attack class wasn't the right solution. So what have we done? We've picked another extremely risky pathway forward with pursuing SSN. So I don't think we're very good at hedging risk. So I'm not hugely optimistic about hedging. So I'll go to some of the questions. I've already been, shall we say, corrected here. Come on, Marcus, we don't just have an obligation to consult under ANZUS. Article 4 says we will, quote, act together to meet a common danger, a much more concrete commitment. And I agree, but, you know, I, as a grumpy strategist, I feel I have the right to cherry pick the quotes I want. But I agree that there is more to ANZUS than just consulting. Yeah, but the way Donald Trump looks at this, wherever it's gone, as a piece of paper, probably not worth the paper it's written on.
I think it's important to say it's not just Trump. America elected Mr. Trump for a second term. America does have a view that other countries have been free riding on it. There's a lot of anger about the deindustrialization. So it's not one man in the White House. He just seems to be a catalyst for all of this.
Yeah, and that's the other reason why in 4 years' time, it's not all going back to normal.
No.
So, all right, next question. Top question. Nine people interested in, are you both looking forward to another bunch of plans, reviews of reviews and feasibility studies? Because surely we haven't reached enough insight into what is needed and by when. So, Michael, you've been tracking the number of reviews that have appeared under the Albanese government and the number of pages. Where are we at the moment?
It is over 12, but it's over 1,200 pages so far of published documents out of the defence organisation under this government. And the good news is we're about to start the cycle all over again, because things like the National Defence Strategy is a commitment to do it every 2 years. So the one thing that we've accelerated is the production of paperwork. So I was very encouraged hearing Mr. Hastie say that would not be, if there was a change of government, how that government would roll. But I think there's a bigger problem.
You're on the record.
There's a bigger problem. I mean, decisions are good, but if you've got the same people and the same machinery, you'll get the same answers. And this is where I think the bipartisanship on defence is now a national problem, because the bipartisanship means the plan is the plan is the plan is the plan. And the plan is not the political parties. The plan is Russell Hill's plan. And whatever happens in the world, it is immutable to change. It is immune to change. So the first thing that needs to happen is the institution needs to be changed. I'm not talking about cultural change. I'm talking about people having to leave it. And I mean the top leadership and a lot down through the star ranks. Because you look at that horribly complicated blancmange Borg of senior leadership wire diagrams, there's no clear line of sight for anyone to a single result. It's like, remember Barry Jones' Knowledge Nation, a big bowl of spaghetti. No one knows what they're responsible for. They know that they've got to align, coordinate, discuss, and canvas about 15 other people at their level. So the first thing that has to happen is the organisation's top structure has to be shrunk and people need to be empowered below that top structure. Otherwise, you get the same answer to the same question again and again and again.
Look, I fundamentally agree with that issue of empowering. Successful organisations empower their people, and when you look at defence, it is just increasing disempowerment. So when you ask the question of why there's so many 3 stars and band 3s in defence now, the answer is, well, no one listens to a band 2 or a 2-star at the table. So if you're a 2-star and no one listens to you, imagine how you feel if going back down through that hierarchy. So, yeah, I think successful organisations...
I don't go to many meetings in Russell now, but I went to one a little while ago, and it was just band 2s and 2-stars. And it was talking about the South China Sea. And there were about a dozen of them there, and they went around the room, and they all gave their job titles. And I've worked in the place for over 20 years, and I could not understand what they were saying. You know, I'm strategy and force design integration for Air Force. I'm Air Force integration strategy and force design. I'm delivery strategy, integration and force matters. I'm alliance integration and strategy thinking and planning. And I just thought, this is word salad. You don't know what any of you do, and I don't know what any of you do. Think about years ago, Tony Ayres was the Secretary of the Department of Defence, and his top structure that he had at the time, there was him, the Secretary. There was a Deputy Secretary for Strategy and Policy, DEPSEC A. There was a Deputy Secretary for the Money, DEPSEC B. There was a Deputy Secretary for Acquisition and Logistics, DEPSEC C. And there was a Chief Defence Scientist. And guess what? They all knew what their job was, and everybody knew what they were responsible for. That simplicity is the best way to deal with a chaotic, complex external environment. Internal complexity means you don't have a moment to even understand the external complexity because you're too busy understanding yourself.
Okay, a question that 12 people have backed, so I can't ignore it. Quite a big question. In your opinions, is the strategy of denial fit for our strategic circumstances? Or should we be looking at something more like strategy of alliance, strategy of hope, make Australia great again, etc.? So, you know, that's a question of, are there alternatives to our current sort of military strategy? Look, I'll say strategy of denial in peacetime is kind of good, because every day that somebody doesn't attack you, has your strategy of denial has worked.
That's a win.
Until that day when they do. And the strategy of denial sort of implies you can impose sufficient cost on them and shape their thinking enough that they're not going to try something on. Until they do. If somebody's going to attack you, they've actually made the calculation that they think that they can, it'll work, and that at an adequate cost to them. And as we've seen with autocrats around the world, they are happy to suffer a huge cost to achieve their gains. So Vladimir Putin doesn't care how many young Russians are killed. It's irrelevant to him. So yeah, there are fundamental weaknesses in a strategy of denial, because it implies that your entire deterrence strategy sort of implies that we're talking the same language and I can raise that cost bar enough to deter you. Well, we're generally not talking the same language, and it's quite doubtful that you can raise that cost bar if it's important enough for them to achieve their goal. So, this emphasis on deterrence, I think, exposes us to some real strategic shocks.
Well, my problem with the strategy of deterrence, which is the current strategy, is it's assumed that it will work. So that means that there's no actual focus on what if deterrence fails and we're in war. Because as you say, there's two wars at the moment. Both the attackers, Hamas and Russia, knew they faced considerable consequences if they attacked, and they did it anyway. So deterrence has failed in the two wars we have now. So the key thing is, what can we do if deterrence fails? And for that, you need to be able to sustain your military in combat for a long period of time. And to do that, you need all the consumables of conflict. And what we just are seeing is, in peacetime, we don't have them, we can't buy them, even though we've placed the order. So in wartime, why do we think we'll have them? This is why national production and hedging with other reliable partners is essential, because the only credible strategy has to rest on an actual ability to use military power if there is a war. And the problem I have with deterrence is people love it because that means they don't have to do the hard thinking, planning and actions to set up a military that can actually operate in war.
So there's a follow-up question which I think is related, and that is, should Australia think about nuclear hedging? Now, I've never been a fan of Australia getting a nuclear weapons capability for a whole bunch of reasons. And one is, you can't do it in a half-assed way. Mm. You certainly can't do it on 2% of GDP unless you want to be a kind of quasi-terroristic organisation that simply says, I've got this weapon and, you know, I might smuggle it in into your homeland.
So, I'm crazy enough that I built it in a half-assed way, so I'm crazy enough to use it.
You know, you look at back to the UK, they're spending sort of 2.3% of GDP on defence, a much bigger GDP than ours. They are going broke. Their defence force is going broke supporting their nuclear capability. So nuclear doesn't mean cheap. That said, what are we learning about the world? Well, we're learning that you can't, if the US is kind of withdrawing from a lot of its alliance commitments, that implies the extended nuclear deterrence umbrella is also shrinking. So there are going to be a lot of countries around the world who are, this is going to become an increasingly live issue for them, particularly when you look at the experience of Ukraine that gave up its nuclear weapons in response for essentially hollow security guarantees.
Well, let me say, no, Australia shouldn't get nuclear weapons, because this is like that, you know, anyone who's done economics, ceteris paribus, you know, all other things being equal. So if we could stop the world...
Off your legal training,
getting
in
all
Latin.
Learned.
Shameless.
If we could stop the world and Australia deciding to get a bomb means nothing else happens, yes, Australia would be safer. But in a world where Australia's getting nuclear weapons, so are a bunch of other countries. And then you start having a nuclear balance that's like a late night in a US saloon in a Western where everyone's drawn their gun. And you're just waiting, hoping no one's going to fire first. So if you want to live in an even more dangerous world than the one we're in now, yes, we and other countries should make a dash for the bomb. We shouldn't do that.
So one very sort of quick question, basically asking, will the US apply pressure on Australia to invest in IAMD? Well, I think the US is going to apply pressure for us to invest in a whole bunch of stuff. So we've already had the discussion about Trump administration pushing NATO to spend 5% of GDP on defence. You know, Pete Hegseth has now said the main game is the Indo-Pacific, i.e. here. That 5% message or direction is coming our way very soon, I believe.
Well, the smart thing to do is to think about what we should be spending ourselves for our own defence and making our plans to do that. We are not making any progress in strengthening our military in dangerous times. We should be doing that. It's embarrassing to have to be blackmailed into increasing our defence capability by America. We should be doing it ourselves. But the big problem, of course, and if I was back sitting in a bureaucratic office, I'd be saying, you've got to be kidding me. You want me to send more money to Russell offices? Those people can't spend the money I'm giving them, and they're not getting results for the $55 billion I'm sending them. What on earth should I give them more money for until they're capable of spending it in a way that gets results? And I'll end by saying we are in a different world to the one our Deputy Prime Minister, who is also still, I think, the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, seems to think he's living in. He, when he's confronted with, are we in a more dangerous time? Do we need to do things urgently for our defence? He says, that's not the cat we're trying to skin. Well, I don't know where his cat is, but it seems to be a long way in the future. Anyway, thank you for your time.
And your time's up, and thank you for the questions.